Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online, radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course, on our podcast. I'm Eddie Packham, and we've all got nosebleeds in association with oldfootballshirts.com. Yes, that's right, last Saturday's win over Watford at the repopulated Amex left us just goal difference for the top spot and had the pundits lavishing praise upon us and also saw the continued renaissance of Shane Duffy. And then on Tuesday night, a side with an average age of just 20.5 knocked a strong Cardiff side out of the Carabao Cup and saw us advance into the third round where we will face Swansea City at home. Today sees a return to league action as we welcome Everton and we will be full of confidence as we look to make it 3 league wins out of 3. Joining me today is, of course, Alan Wes, and we are delighted to welcome a man who played 172 times for his hometown club, scoring 7 goals before going on to star for Bournemouth, Aston Villa, Hull and Huddersfield before announcing his retirement last week. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Tommy Elphick.
Hey, Tommy, welcome to the Raw, mate.
Thanks for having me.
Well, yeah, Tommy, I mean, before we get cracked, firstly, congratulations on an absolutely brilliant career.
Yeah, appreciate that. Blighted by injuries, but yeah, it was the right time for me to call it a day. I've had a good run at it. Managed to do a lot more than most and played for some fantastic clubs, met some great people. Just really happy, content. And yeah, I think it's the right decision.
Okay, so starting at the end, mate, what finally did for you?
Yeah, it was just one too many injuries. It was the injuries that did put me in a position to make a decision, I suppose. I had a long time out. I had a long time thinking about what was next for me. And it basically come down. I was fed up sitting on a physio bed. It was just coming away from training. I wasn't able to give what I thought I should still be giving. I'd had plenty of talks along the way. I was out 18 months, so I had plenty of people that I sounded out about potential opportunities going forward after football, and there's something waiting for me that I'm sort of really happy with. It's sort of the end of the playing days and on something new.
Because, I mean, you're still very young. I mean, you're still only 33. So, I mean, you know, I mean, when you see a lot of like the likes of how long Guy Butters went on for and stuff, it must be, you know, gutting to actually...
I said, make him feel better, AD.
Do you know what? It's not actually gutting. I'm actually really happy with it. And when I announced it, I was sort of saying to myself, I wish I announced it 6 weeks earlier. I knew in my head. And I think because of the way, like, if you take someone like Guy Butters... He started at the top at a very good club with Tottenham and sort of gradually come down as he went along. But with me, my career sort of went, I started in then the lower leagues, if you like, with Brighton, got to a certain level. And I didn't want to be that guy coming back down. The game's changed a lot as well since someone like, if you name check Guy Butters, since he was coming down, the game has changed a lot since then. And it is a young man's game. And I suppose that the defining factor for me was I'd rather be a young, aspiring and improving coach, if you like, than an old declining player who's going down through the leagues and becomes forgotten.
Yeah. Well, okay. Well, let's go back to the beginning then. And your debut, which was a game which had a very strong family feel about it. It was at Reading on the 10th of December, 2005. And your brother, who was making his first and last start for the Albion, and you came on as a sub in that game. We should also note that Gary did also get sent off.
Make him feel better, AD.
And we lost 5-1. So, you know, great start for you, mate.
Yeah, I actually got an assist that day as well, AD, so it wasn't all bad. I don't suppose it's ever happened before, weird sort of scenario for the family. Proud moment for us all, my brother making his start that he didn't really find out till on the day. Me being involved in travelling, didn't find out I was on the bench until the day. So, yeah, it was all good up until then. But I actually felt for my brother because he had been doing really well, playing really, really well in the reserves. And he should have made a living out of the pro game, really, but stuff didn't really fall for him. And going back, I remember playing a Sussex Senior Cup game on the Thursday night. We were playing the best team in the division on the Saturday, and me and my brother were playing centre-halves in the Sussex Senior Cup on a Thursday night. I think it was down at, might have even been Hastings, where he's playing now, and it was an absolute bog. Went into extra time, went into penalties. So he had played 120 minutes, come in the next day to train and do a recovery session, and then he finds out he's playing in a back three away against the best side in the division who set all sorts of records. So I think they were setting him up for a bit of a failure there. But yeah, it was up against it from the minute the whistle went. And yeah, as I say, it was a bittersweet moment for the family.
Let's at least talk about the time, you know, the period leading up to that Reading game. Like I said, I mean, it was a funny old day when, you know, I'm struggling to think of the previous time that two brothers were on. The Foxes spring to mind, and that's about it. But so, you know, in that time, you know, from when you first started at the club, how you progressed and tell us about that journey that took you to that first game at Reading.
We had the most brilliant youth team. I think 13 of us actually went on to become apprentices. And the club were taking a massive, we was all at that time, as you know, we was reliant so much on the youth team, and not just one or two coming through every year, but we needed three or four, and probably to sell one on or to sort of make the club survive. So we knew that there was a pathway, and had the most unbelievable youth team. As I said, 13 of us went on to get apprentices. We had coaches like Ian Chapman, who stayed with us a long time because they knew that we were such a good age group. I think he took us from 13s probably all the way up to 16s, and then even went on to become first team coach when a lot of us broke into the first team. So we had a real competitive streak about us. We went on, again, as I say, we went on to get to, I think it was the last eight of the FA Youth Cup, and we was that sort of golden generation, if you like, where I think six or seven of us went on to make debuts, which is crazy, really. So yeah, I think that competitive nature, because everyone was so good in that youth team, you had to survive, you know. And I was always having to find a way and stick in there, and times I wouldn't change. Like, I look at how some of these youngsters come through now, and the red carpet is laid out for them, they get given everything. For us, it was the opposite, you know. You had to fight to survive. And the senior lads that we had to look up to at the time, the likes of Guy Butters, Danny Cullip, Richard Carpenter, Charlie Oakway, Kerry Mayo, Gary Hart, they were just such good role models, and they were such good people to learn, to teach you the way, really. So yeah, times I absolutely loved.
Yeah. I mean your debut came under Mark McGee, which we might talk about in a minute. But I mean, that you were talking about that youth team, and the fact that, you know, Dean Wilkins went on to become manager, and you had Martin Hinchelwood there, you had Vic Bragg. These guys, I mean, it was Dean's dream to have put out an entire team of Sussex born and bred players. And you know what? He nearly did it.
Yeah, he did. When you look at the likes, there was me. I don't think me and Joel actually played too many games at centre-half together. When you look back now, it's crazy, but it was me and Joel. Tommy Fraser obviously went on to make nearly 100 games. I think Joe Gatton probably got to the same sort of mark. But yeah, there was lads there, like goalkeeper, like Richard Martin, who was going to be the next best thing, and everybody was after, didn't quite get through and make it. John Sullivan, who went on to make some appearances. Paul Inchwood, Adam's brother. Wes Fogden played plenty, didn't he? Sam Rent. So yeah, it was a great, really, really talented group. And not many actually went on and stayed in the game, which was a shame, actually.
Like, well, I mean, there was Dean Cox, Jake Robinson.
Well, no, they stayed in the game, mate, believe me.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so who left the game? Because, I mean, at the time, you know, we'd go and watch the Albion youth side, and, you know, I mean, I know this was probably after your time being in the youth side, but there's plenty of us that remember turning up to with Dean to play Chelsea, and it was a glamour tie in the FA Cup. So I think you were a senior player by this time, but there was obviously, you know, I think probably because there had to be at that time a huge amount of interest in the youth team, because, you know, this was the, you know, Brighton's future. And even then, when the stadium was uncertain, you know, were you aware of sort of the, not just the pressure for yourself to get through to make it as a professional, but, you know, what it meant to the club for so many to come through?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't pressure for me. It was just, it was the best opportunity possible. And I remember Aston Villa, because of probably what happened with Gareth Barry and Michael Stan, and Aston Villa used to take a huge interest in our academy, knowing that they could come and get players. And I think about four or five of our lads went up to train with Aston Villa when they were sort of 17, 18, and the club were probably looking to maybe do a deal and cash in on them at that stage, and it never quite happened. But yeah, it wasn't so much, it was the pathway was there, you know, you could see there was lads like Dean Ammon making a living at it, Adam Alab, who was getting there and playing most weeks, and this was at the Championship as well. Jake Robinson, he come onto the scene really early, didn't he? Coxie, you know, them lads were getting through before us, and for me it was just a massive opportunity that you could go and give yourself a platform, because that's what it was about. It was about giving yourself a platform to maybe move on one day, you know, go and make a proper living for yourself, and hopefully the club could cash in and benefit from that. But then times did change when Tony Bloom and his family got involved. You could sense that we wasn't going to be that club that was all about selling on and whatnot. And there was a bit of a long-term project. And that was I remember in my first year playing in the first team, and speaking to Mick McCarthy a couple of times about going to Wolves. And there was plenty of interest one January that I had a few options that I could have gone and gone on to, and the club maybe could have cashed in on me, but they put a contract in front of me and sold me this dream about getting into the Amex, and there was going to be a training ground coming, and you could sense that the club was on the up, you know. And everything in football is timing and a little bit of luck, and for me it was the right time. The club was progressing, I was progressing, so yeah, it was the right place to be.
And it's your hometown club where your heart is.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I was one of them fans who was in the U block out with Dean, giving a bit of banter to the away fans that used to sort of sit opposite, and we were so far away from the goal. Yeah, I used to love that, watching the likes of Danny Cullip and Richard Carpenter, as I said, the lads who I mentioned before, and then going on to share a pitch with them. It does mean a little bit more. So to say, as I say, to say that I went on and played the games that I did for the first team and have success, it's something that I'm really proud of.
Okay. Well, you properly got yourself established in the team under Dean Wilkins. And I mean, we mentioned that he wanted to get this Sussex team out on the pitch. But he was a very, very good coach. But I mean, it's been said that he wasn't the greatest manager. I mean, is that fair?
No, I don't think so. When you actually look what he did with that team and where we finished, I honestly think if the club had kept him there and progressed it a little bit, we wouldn't have been far from the playoffs the next season. You know, we wasn't actually far away from it the year that he had us. And for me, I've only got great things to say about him. As a coach, still I've been on to see some unbelievable coaches and as I say, like played for some really good clubs, and yeah, I'd still have him up there with one of the best that I've ever come across. And as a manager, you say that, but look at the amount of kids that him, Hinch and Vic were producing for so many years. That takes managing. You have to manage expectations. Yeah. So,
what was it about Dean that made? I mean, obviously he was with you as a when you were a youngster, and you kind of almost like progressed together to a point. What was it about him that's so endeared you to him?
Just the time and effort that he used to give you. He was so forward thinking. You know, we're going back to a day where there was no analysis or there was no GPS, and he was trying to tap into these even years before we had known about it or heard about it. He was even on the scene. He was trying to do that. His technical, the technical aspect of his coaching was just ridiculous, really. Down to little things like what foot you take off when you jump and what foot you're using to clear the ball. He was massive on foot patterning and biomechanics, and he was just buying into absolutely everything that he could. Him between him, Hinch and Vic, they're the ones that schooled so many lads to give them like good careers. I mean, if you talk to the likes of Dean Hammond, Adam Alab, Joel Lynch, you know, that I'm sure them lads who went on to play plenty of games in the leagues, you know, that they would say the same.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, I mean, it was, you got established in the side in 2007-08, and you mentioned the fact that you had Guy Butters alongside you, and he was a great help to you, wasn't he?
Yeah, loved him. And again, like for all that these coaches were doing for us. I remember that actually the year before I was sort of playing most reserve games, and at that time reserve games still meant quite a bit. You know, you didn't have no 23s, and you'd likely have someone like Kerry Mayo or Guy Butters, Richard Carpenter in front of you. It might be Michelle behind you. And I just used to think playing 90 minutes with one of them lads who have played 300, 400, 500 games, you used to learn more in 90 minutes than what you would do in months of coaching. And I've gone on to say like what a massive help for me Guy was. And I was quite revved in my early days and on the metal. And some of the lessons that Guy taught me and yeah, some of the little messages that he used to give me, they just send me through and stuck with me for all my career.
So Tom, when you see what the club's doing now then, in regards to, we've got Gary Dicker playing in the 23s now, we had Andrew Cross playing in the 23s, and as giving them that, like having that role model figure that you had with those guys in reserves. I mean, obviously I don't think your body's probably willing anymore, but was that a role that you would see as successful and something that other clubs should be doing?
It depends really. Like, do you know what? The standard of 23s football is actually very good and you have to be able to do it. And if you go in there, it's like an old school player manager, if you like, when you look back at people like Glenn Hoddle when he took over at Swindon or whoever it may be. You have to be blooming good to go in and do that. And if you're going to be given the platform to teach these kids lessons, you need to be the one doing it, not only on the when you're playing, but when you're coaching as well. So it can be a very tough gig, that. But for me, yeah, as you say, the injuries have sort of dictated that a little bit more to me. And it was a role I possibly would have considered, but yeah, probably wouldn't have been able to do, to be honest.
You do know what how Guy Butters described your partnership when he was playing. Obviously, it was at the tail end of his career. He said, "I love playing alongside Tommy. He does all the work and I just mop up the mess."
Yeah, but it's like that. And like, if you'd probably asked Lewis Dunk about his debut when I played with him and I was perhaps the senior one, he did all the work and I mopped up all the mess. Do you know what I mean? But it works both ways. And listen, he instilled something in me that is very rare these days. Football, as we all know, is becoming a business and everyone's out for themselves. And it's very, very hard to come by these lads that are willing to put someone else in front of themselves. And Guy was one of them people. I think when we was coming through as kids, you know, the likes of my brother who I looked up to, myself and other lads who work so hard for their living, them senior lads used to take a shine to us and try and take us under their wing and look out for us and take care of us. So I'll forever be indebted, not to only Guy, but all them senior lads at that time.
Yeah. Sure. We actually have a story about you and Lewis Dunk, don't we, AD?
Not true.
It's totally true, isn't it, AD?
No.
Shall I repeat the story for our listener?
Well, it's good. It's got. It's been repeated. It's Chinese whispers now, Al. You weren't actually there.
No, listen. I'm happy to take the first-hand evidence of those who, like your friends, who I think it was at Milton Keynes Dons, probably the last day of the season. You've been playing cricket in a pub with inflatables, and you were getting a little bit exasperated, and you were screaming, "Come on, Tommy, pull your finger out!" And everyone else had to say, "Do you realise that's actually Lewis Dunk?"
It's possible.
We're doing this program on Zoom. We can see Tommy now, and those lovely, flowing, almost Italianate locks from 10, 12 years ago have all gone. And he looks more like Lewis Dunk than he ever did before.
When I do go back home or whatnot, I went back about 6 weeks ago and I pulled up outside a restaurant. Someone had cooked some dinner for us the night before. I had to drop the stuff back and there was lads up in the window. I think it was Channel Glaze and they were looking down and they were placing some window. I've got out the car. I've pulled something out of the car and run it into the restaurant. And as I've come back, they've gone. It was the weekend after Brighton had stayed up. They've gone, "Well done, mate. Brilliant for staying up." And I've looked up, I've gone, Huddersfield had only just stayed up. I thought, "Oh, yeah." Thanks, mate. And another lad's run out and he said, "You are staying this year, ain't you?" And I said, "Oh, no, my knees are shot to pieces. I'm calling it a day." It weren't until I drove away and my missus was in the car and I said, they thought I was Lewis Dunk.
Well, be careful if you're this season.
Yeah, I'm glad it wasn't just me. But okay, I mean, there was that season, I mean, there was a change in the guard. There was a bit of an issue with Dean Hammond and his contracts offer, and eventually going that January. And there was talk of the fact that it really affected the dressing room. I mean, how much truth is there in that?
Yeah, it did. And Baz Savage as well. There was a lot of, I don't know if Baz did end up leaving that January or left in the, I think he left that January, but like just characters like Dino was our, he was our skipper, you know, he was the one we all looked up to when we was coming through in the youth team. Our hard, his story was actually incredible. You know, he got released and then he come back. I think he signed a 2-week contract, then it turned into a 3-month contract. Then he's all of a sudden the club captain again, you know. So it was, Dean was an inspirational figure for all us youngsters coming through at that time. And it was tough to see someone like that leave. And then on top of that, Baz. And we were really, really getting something going. The team spirit was just brilliant. And as I say, them older lads, the likes of Gary Hart, Kerry Mayo, Guy Butters, the ones that would look after us youngsters and give us the platform to perform. You know, it was a great balance and a mix. And just a real shame that we couldn't have had another season together, because I think we would have knocked on the door to the playoffs.
I mean, that same window, we did see another player arrive, and he went on to be an absolute Albion legend. And he like you, has just announced his retirement as well. And that was, of course, Glenn Murray.
Yeah, great friend of mine. Love him to bits, and someone who, you know, when you get to these stages in your career, you know, you sort of can count on two hands how many people you actually stay in contact with. And me and Muzzy, yeah, we've stayed in contact from the first day we met. We played a lot of golf together in the summer, and you know, I mean, just what an absolute legend he's gone on to be for the club. But if you'd have told me he'd have gone on to do what he'd have done, like, I'd have laughed at you, because no longer really had sort of moved down and settled in. I remember actually helping him unpack his lorry that he had driven down with all his stuff from Carlisle, but he really, really struggled to settle in. I mean, I'm sure he's told all the stories before and everybody knows, but really homesick. Him and his partner at the time had just had a young baby, and it was tough for him. And yeah, as I say, for him to have gone on and done what he's done for the club, yeah, absolute legend.
Kind of laid back though, isn't he?
Yeah, he is, but if there's a ball and a net in front of him, he changes. So he is laid back, he is, but he has that, he's got an inner sort of steeliness and drive that would actually really surprise you. And you only really get to see that when you played with him or when you're on the golf course these days.
Sure.
But Tom, I mean, that season as well, I mean, we'll move on from that shortly, but I mean, you did get player of the season that year as well, which was amazing for you.
Yeah, I was on top of the world, to be honest. And we had some great players, as you say, players like Muzza. Nicky Forster had a great season that year. Guy probably had one of his best years ever as well. So, as I say, we had done a lot. And I remember that summer there was a lot of interest. And, yeah, it was just a really, really, like, fun time for me. And, yeah, what played some of my best football, really, that season. And I remember going away, we all went away together, the lads. I think we went to Magaluf or something like that. And we was actually boarding the plane on the way back, and a few of the older lads were getting texts that Dean had been sort of sacked. And, yeah, it was strange, really. It took a long time to get over that, because we wasn't talking about a manager that was just in charge for a season. For us lads, like, we'd sort of been with Dean since we was 15. And, you know, you're getting sort of 20 now, it's a long time to have been, and you go through a lot with someone like that, so it was tough to get over. Yeah.
Well, Mickey Adams came back in and it wasn't a great success, but there was a couple of things that did stand out under his breath, which was that the Man City game in the cup, where there was a pitch invasion led by someone in the mobility scooter, which is still one of my favourite
images. You absolutely love it. Everyone else might not have been there, might not even bother to have been there. It's just that one bloke. He wasn't doing donuts on there, admittedly, but he, you know, the
it got up to quite a lick, though. I mean, it was,
considering it was going across a bog.
Yeah, it was amazing. I mean, talk us through that game, because that was that was Man City had just been taken over by the Sheikhs. You know, they just signed Rabina, and the side they had out that day was pretty strong, say the least.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. Again, Mickey's time. Like, I loved Mickey. Like, thought he was a great manager, and yeah, it was just probably the wrong time for him. As I say, there was a lot of hangover from Dean sacking. It was coming back to a club maybe sometimes isn't the best thing to do as a manager. And yeah, it was a tough gig for him to take over, really. But that was a real highlight. I remember scoring a penalty and, yeah, just seeing the team sheet come through that day. And there was, I think it was a transfer window, wasn't it? The window was open and they'd just been taken over. And they was throwing cash around everywhere. And we thought, oh, surely they don't want to play all these lads. And lo and behold, they all turn up and we give them the right scene too.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we left it to the last minute, but you know, when you're a third division player, and at that time, obviously, you hadn't played at a higher level, and you're playing at a club where, you know, they're still, you know, batting against the odds, things aren't completely, as you're pointing out, tickety boo in the dressing room. Yeah. You know, did you sort of like think, oh, the writing's on the wall here? Because, you know, hang on, we're just, you know, every single aspect of this said a good hiding. With all due respect, I mean, how do you actually approach this? Do you think, oh my God, you know, we've just got to batten down the hatches, or do you think, you know, gung ho, let's do this? How do you approach it?
It's a free hit, isn't it? I mean, especially with what was going on in the league, we was having a tough time, and well, really tough time, and things were looking very hairy, and yeah, it just becomes a free hit, doesn't it? And when you're at a club like Brighton at that time, you're sort of thinking to yourself, you just never know. I remember playing Derby in the Cup once, and previous summer or whatnot, they had sort of shown a little bit of interest in me. And yeah, you sort of go into the game thinking, oh, if I do well here, you just never know, you might get that move and change your life or change sort of the fortunes for the club a little bit. So yeah, it was more for us younger players, it was that. I imagine for the older lads, it was like, Jesus, let's just get through the first 15 minutes and see where it takes us.
Yeah. I mean, we did do very well, but like, move on from that. I mean, Mickey's tenure, I mean, it ended after losing 4-0 at home to Crewe. It's incredible. I mean, yeah. Actually, do you know who scored the fourth goal that day for Crewe?
No.
I'll give you a clue. He's playing against us tomorrow.
Tell me.
Gylfi Sigurdsson.
Jesus.
But
are you sure it's the same bloke?
Yeah, no, it's the same bloke. Yeah.
Oh, blimey. Okay.
But
I think Mickey's tenure came at the end. It was actually after the Luton JPT, whatever it was called back in those days, penalty shootout, and you know, which started off as a howler between Vergs and Kuipers, and didn't really get going after that, did it?
No, and I remember that was a massive game for us because we was one game away from Wembley, and I remember Fozzie. Was however old Foz was at the time, 35 or 36, he'd never played at Wembley. And he was just banging on to us, like, lads, you could go through, look at me, I'm 35, 36. You don't get these chances to play at Wembley. Like, let's go and I think we might have been drawing or might have even, it was two legs, wasn't it? We might have even been winning.
Going it was 0-0 at home and we went to the second leg and it went to penalties. And
I didn't play. I remember getting to the game and we'd signed Adam Virgo and he had played every position that he could have possibly played except half, which he was brought in to do. And that night, Mickey pulled me. He said, I'm going to rest you tonight. It's only the Johnson's paint. The league's more important. And he played Virgs at centre-half. And then, yeah, that sort of mistake happened. I think someone got sent off and then he brought me on. But, yeah, it was a strange time. Just never really got going. Never really had the chemistry back in the dressing room that season because of what had gone on. And, yeah, it was a tough gig for Mickey that year.
Mm. Okay, well, we'll come back to that in a minute. But first, you're listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM. Online at RadioReverb.com on DAB and, of course, on our podcast. We are delighted, as ever, to be brought to you in association with OldFootballShirts.com. And, Tommy, if you could just have a little look at this shirt and tell me what you think of it. Can you describe it for me?
Just describe it or say what I think it is.
Well, who do you think it is? Mate. It's both.
Both.
Well, it's green and white. Ibis Hotel. I've got a feel. Diadora, you don't see many Diadora kits. I don't know, it looks Portuguese to me.
Al?
Yeah, well, I actually was going to say, I mean, Ibis is obviously an international hotel chain. The only thing that, the thing that immediately sprang to mind for me on with the green and white stripes would be Real Betis. But above and beyond that, this is going to be one of Phil's bizarre third team shirts of someone who plays on Madagascar, you know, in 1972.
Well, I will tell you, Mr. Wares, that the esteemed Mr. Elphick here is correct in the country. It is Portuguese. And so that tells you what language I've now got to speak. So
oh, no.
Wish me luck.
Oh, no.
So this is the 2005 to 2006 home shirt of Portuguese League 3 side Vitória de Setúbal. Based in the coastal city of Setúbal, the side was formed in 1910 and they play at the Estádio do Bonfim, which has a capacity of 15,497. That's a lot of sardine pies, says Phil. Vitória have won the Cup of Portugal three times, the League Cup once and the Iberian Cup once, but their most interesting trophy has to be the 1970 Small Club World Cup. What? This was a tournament played in Venezuela between 1952 and 75 and was contested between four clubs variously selected from Spain, Portugal, Brazil, Colombia, Czechoslovakia and East Germany. In addition to these successes, they've also played in the Cup Winners' Cup and the Fairs Cup, famously knocking out Liverpool in the 69-70 tournament. Unable to obtain a licence for the 2021 season due to financial reasons, they went into administration and were relegated to League Three. The record for all-time appearances for Vitória is held by Joaquim Salafin, who went on by the name Quinn and was a one-club man, and he made 436 appearances between 85 and 2001. And Phil's felt it necessary to mention the current player, a Mozambican called Camo Kumban. So good, they named him twice.
Say that name again.
It was Camo Kumban.
No, that was by Culture Club, that song.
Oh, God. Yeah, there's no Brighton links, really. Last year, apparently, Albion were interested in signing midfielder Ryan Gould, who was at Sporting, and had played alone at Vitória before he chose the MLS and Vancouver Whitecaps.
Why did Phil choose that, AD?
Because he likes it.
Probably. Well, you can actually view that and 115,000 other shirts. I guess now that the season's started and all the new shirts have come out, there will be a whole new set of additions going on to that site. So that 115,000 is going to be a small number very soon. But if you just head over to the world's largest online gallery of football shirts at oldfootballshirts.com. And thanks, as ever, to Phil Shelley for sponsoring this show. Just a quick notice board, AD, if I may. Friday the 8th of October at the American Express Community Stadium. Do you remember that thing? Is that that monolith that they built in the middle of a farmer's field a few years ago? Tommy remembers it. At the Mayo Wynn Baxter Lounge, we'll be holding the 11th Robert Eaton Memorial Fun Quiz Night. Teams of up to six may enter. It'll be £5 per person, pay on the night with folding stuff. We're not taking cards. Pay cash on the night. There'll be a raffle there. Yours truly will be the host, like it or lump it, for the Robert Eaton Memorial Fun Quiz Trophy, a much sought-after prize. Steve Agace, please remember to bring it back. So, yes, Friday the 8th of October, starts at 7.30 in the Mayo Wynn Baxter Lounge. That's the big main one in the West Stand. Everyone, welcome. Just email alan.wares at ntlworld to let me know if you're coming or if you've got a query or two. So, yeah, hopefully see you then, if not before.
Okay. Good stuff, and I will try and be there this year. That'll be good.
But, well, we've got Tommy Elphick with us. Tommy,
we do.
Getting to the end of Mickey Adams, and it didn't really work. And then we've got AD's lookalike came in as manager. And I've just been given, quite rightly, had the V flicked at me. Tell us about Russell Slade, mate.
Yeah, really interesting time on and off the pitch. But... Jesus, what a marvellous job he did to keep the club up. We was down and out. But yeah, he just come in like a whirlwind, really. We did have a few egos at the time. I think he got rid of them. Found out very quickly the ones he could trust. Got us very, very organised in a very basic way to sort of pay it a bit of a compliment. But yeah, we just had to go and get a job done, and we got it done just through having good characters and battling away, really.
That's an interesting point you make there as a professional. I mean, effectively a season of two halves or two thirds and one third there. I mean, we're talking about largely the same squad, which you say he did cut back a little bit. But when it's the same squad, how can it be so different? What changed between working under one manager and working under another manager, given that it's the same set of players effectively?
I think Mickey's maybe downfall was that he had bought players in, bigger players, if you like, that he probably felt he had to justify by playing them. The squad did end up getting a bit bloated with lads that yeah, were probably just collecting a wage at that stage of their career. Yeah.
He used 40 players that year.
Do you know what I mean? So it says all you need to know. And I think if you, out of them 40 players, it would be interesting to see how many Russell Slade used.
Sure.
And yeah, when you've got good people, I'm a massive, massive believer in good people. When you've got good people pulling in the same direction, you can move mountains, which we had to do with 8 games to go. I think we had to win 7. Always remember Hereford away. Good pal of mine at the time, Tommy Fraser, scoring our overhead kick. He fell over, lent on it, and yeah, it went in. But even Bristol Rovers away, like Lloyd Owusu and Gary Hart just found a brilliant chemistry, didn't they? With scoring goals from nowhere. And
I would say this, Tommy, there was anyone away fans, I wasn't there, I don't think Aidy was there, but all those away fans who made that trip, they talk about that particular night. Maybe you can tell us about it, that there was something a bit special that night.
Yeah, it was. It was just almost like, well, here we go. We found our way. We know what we're about, and we know we're not very good, but we can dig in, and we had an energy. And I remember the fans being down in that bottom corner, but there was no sort of roof over the stand at that time. And yeah, it was quite a hot day, I think. And Lloydie giving it the old raise the roof, and yeah, it just seemed timing and momentum's everything. And people like Lloyd Owusu, you know what he did when he come in. Absolutely brilliant. Calvin Andrew, I remember, come in, he got a horrific injury last game of the season. But and then obviously Fozzie's goal to keep us up, which was never going to be anybody else, was it?
Let's face it, the end of that season was all about Gary Hart though, really, wasn't it?
Harty had done fabulous, yeah. Again, it hadn't been easy for him at the club. He was playing all sort of different positions in sort of his later stages. Probably was looking to be phased out a little bit when Dean Wilkins come in with the youth team and youth team coming up. You know, them older lads were probably fretting a little bit, but it shows what it was all about when you had people like him showing the good side out and helping us younger lads. And then when his time come to be called upon, he was there for the club still. So yeah, that's where the game's changed a lot. Then them characters that there's not so many about these days.
What's the interesting thing about Hart is he took that all the way through. To the end of with Dean and very briefly into the Amex. I mean, you know, for all the facts that we've got, for the famously a grand and a set of tracksuits and the shift he put in, like you say, playing in every position. I think he even went in goal one time. I do remember, and we'll talk about Gus Poyet in a minute, but I do remember Gus sort of saying a do one time, and he said, you know, he pointed out Harty and said, you know, if I had 11 players in my team, if I had all the players like that in my squad, my job would be so much easier. I mean, you're talking about egos earlier. I mean, let's face it, Gus Poyet and egos are not sort of like, you know, particular strangers. But when he recognises someone who's going to knuckle down, let's say that's probably, he's a fellow that you would actually, in your earlier, you know, sort of statement, say is a good person.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And he started playing right back as well, just when I was sort of breaking onto the scene. So I was playing with him and alongside him, if you like. And yeah, they were just great, great lads. That there's so many of them, like I've probably not mentioned enough, but that era, they was the lads I used to watch. Do you know what I mean? And those were the lads who I was cleaning their boots, and they was, without knowing it, they was teaching me how to be a pro, how to conduct yourself, what was right, what was wrong. Getting a clip round the ear hole for not cleaning boots properly, or, you know, not getting the balls in quick enough. There's all these little lessons that we're losing in football now that, you know, part of the motivation for me staying in the game is the lessons that I was taught by that group. And yeah, Harty epitomised that for so many years. And there is still a DNA at Brighton that still stands through the likes of Gary Hart, through the likes of Kerry Mayo. And without them lads keeping the club in the Football League and then keeping us in League One and then getting us to the Championship. Without them certain lads, the club wouldn't be where it is now.
But okay, well, Gus did come in and it changed the club's fortunes massively. And it was the beginning of an upward trajectory, not just for ourselves, but also for you as well, Tommy, really, because, I mean, you've got to play at the highest level. Well, obviously, you played in the Premier League for Bournemouth, but, you know, he got us up and out of this league and into the Championship. And that Championship winning team was absolutely brilliant. And you scored one of the crucial goals in that, which was the first goal away at Plymouth, which we, having spoken to Gordon and Elliot and everyone else the other week, they were saying that was the game that really they made us believe that we could actually get out of here.
Yeah, I mean, I know, like, you've just alluded to Gus and some of the faults that he had, but for me, like, it really is a short head between him and Eddie Howe, the best ever. I cannot talk highly enough of Gus Poyet. He just opened my eyes again to football. The way he used to break a game down, what he used to see, his honesty with the players, sometimes too honest. I always remember his first meeting when he said, like, don't be coming. My door is always open. Every manager says it. But unless you want to come in and hear the truth, don't be coming and knocking on my door. And the football.
What truths did he give to you then, Tommy?
Probably the biggest standout, without going too long-winded with this, but I remember when he signed Gordon Greer. We went away to Portugal that season to do a pre-season training camp, and he pulled me and Gigi together. And he said, you'll be my first choice centre half. But Gigi had had a ban from the playoffs the year before. He had kicked someone, I think that Swindon Charlton, he kicked someone, he had a 3 or 4 game ban going into the season. So me and Adam Ladd were going to start the season. But he pulled me and Gigi, said, look, this is the number one pairing. But Gigi, just be aware, Tommy's been flying. I wouldn't be surprised if he's not with us beyond Christmas. So I'm like feeling Man Mountain D now. Do you know what I mean? he's like, well, I'm going to either get a move or we're going to go up, or brilliant. So we have a great pre-season. We're doing what we do. Get to the first game of the season. Then again, he pulls me and Adam Alab now. And Adam, I think we were all sort of, if we were all being honest, he was like producing football that we never knew he was capable of. Like, so if you ever want to sort of put some reasoning on why I think Gus is so good, what he was doing with us players to not only improve us as a team, but improve us as individuals, like, there's a measure of it there with Adam. But he pulls the pair of us and he says, look, you're starting the season, but I'm telling you now, whoever makes the first mistake, I don't care whether it leads to a goal or doesn't lead to a goal, leads to us winning, not winning. Whoever makes the first mistake will be out the team, because I bought Gigi in. He's a big investment for the club. He's the club captain now and he's come into play. So we start the season off, I think we go score Plymouth away. We're flying, playing some great football. And then we played Bournemouth at home on an early kickoff on TV. Ball comes over. I've gone up for a header with Big Fletch. Wasn't even our ball. Give a penalty away.
Floodgates are open. Now, this incident has been talked about more than any other incident. We can tell you who the referee, who the linesman was, what colour, like, shirt, like, him was wearing, and the fact that there was a handball outside the area by somebody wearing long sleeves.
Yeah.
You were wearing short sleeves.
I know. Well, look, this will tell you, this was my frustration, AD. So we draw the game 1-1, and we go to Charlton the next week, and I'm thinking, I'm absolutely flying here. I'm playing the best football of my life. We were either top or second. You know, there's no way. I know what he said to me, but there is absolutely no way you can take me out the side here. Lo and behold, we get to Friday, he names the team, and he left me out. I've got a cob on. We go away to Charlton, we win 4-0, so I've not even got a leg to stand on Monday at training to have a Barney with him. But on the Sunday, I'm sitting at home on the Sunday and I'm having lunch around my mum and dad's, and my phone pings about 2:30, and there's a message from Gus, and he sent me this like long message about what he thought of me, how well I've been doing now, and how we was going to have this long relationship together, and don't worry, something will happen, I'll get back in the side, I'm a massive part of what he's doing on and off the pitch, and I love you. Like, it was just, it was the first time I thought, crikey, like, there's a manager sitting there on a Sunday afternoon, like, he's got so many things to be doing, and he's actually taking his time out to text me, and get in on the Monday, and he said, I just said, like, listen, appreciate the text, Gaffer. Like, really appreciate it. Yeah, don't worry. Relax. Stay calm with it. Long-term contracts, all this. You've got nothing to worry about. And he said to me, who in your life, like, influences your career? And I said, oh, well, I speak to my dad every day about football, my brother, and I suppose my agent. He said, right, well, this is what we're going to do. Bring them all in to training tomorrow after training. So I was like, well, okay, this is weird. And so I tell my dad and my agents, we all get to the training ground after training. And we just sat in his office for about 2 hours, just talking about life and football and what he saw me doing and how much he thought of me. And it was just like, little things like that he used to do. It was just no other manager would be like that. And but he said, he laid it down. He said, whoever makes the first mistake, I don't care whether it's your fault, not your fault, leads to a goal, doesn't lead to a goal, leads to winning, not, you'll come out the side. And when it's laid down to you black and white like that, you cannot argue.
That's tough, isn't it?
But you did mention contracts there, and you were the first player to be contracted into the Amex era. I mean, that must have made you feel pretty special as well.
Very, very special. I remember sitting in the offices. I think they was in the North Lanes at the time. I remember sitting down with Dick Knight. I had plenty of interest around the time. Mick McCarthy had been ringing quite a bit. He was at Wolves. They'd just got relegated from the Premier League. And yeah, there was a number of clubs sort of on me, I suppose, at the time. And yeah, I remember sitting with Dick and my agent, and he spelled out the vision and put a contract in front of me. I think it was a five-year deal at the time, which the club had never, ever been able to commit to something like that. So it meant a huge, huge amount. And the dream was for me to lead the club out at the Amex, but unfortunately with injuries and the way things went, didn't quite happen.
Just to put a final sort of closure on that little sort of Gordon Greer coming to the club, and you mentioned him being suspended for the first few games because of his red card in the playoffs. If you want to hear how his first game for the Albion went, then go back to the two-part Gordon Greer alongside Elliot Bennett and Gary Dicker. And Gordon is very open and honest and candid about what a hooligan he was in his first game. So I don't know if Gus actually said the same thing to you. If you know, GG, if you make a mistake, you're out. And he was for about four games. But in that particular show, we chose those guys. They were part of it was the 10th anniversary, and obviously you were a major part of that. So we'll talk about highlights if you have any. But that particular season. Now, I appreciate that it was actually possibly topped off by winning the championship with Bournemouth, but this is the Albion roar. Tell us about that last season with Dean, that championship, League One winning side.
Just that we had a great group, and again, it comes back to my methods going forward to be about good people, and we had such good people in the dressing room, people like Elliot Bennett, Ashley Barnes, lads like Chris Wood on loan. We had two Argentinian lads, Bata Piedi and Chino, didn't we?
Baz.
Baz and Gordon come in, he was the skipper and he set a precedent in training every single day. We had the bit between the teeth and you could see the club was going in the right direction. And to, as I say, again, timing in football is everything. To end such a turbulent time with Dean on that high, because it was, listen, we had great times with Dean, with the older lads, the old guard, if you like, getting promoted. But then coming back down, it was always... You know, it was always uncertainty, wasn't it? But to end that time where the club had come back home and to go into this wonderful new stadium, it was just, you couldn't write it really, could you? And we even went great cup runs. I remember because there was a period I wasn't playing so much. We go into places like Stoke away when those in the Premier League and going toe-to-toe with them, Aston Villa in the FA Cup. And yeah, it was just a really, really fun season.
Right, hits the pause button there. Aston Villa, that's... We asked people about their fondest memories of you playing for the Albion, and one of the big ones that did come up was the Villa Cup game. That was a major day for you, surely.
Yeah, and it actually sowed a seed for me down the line. My granddad, who's not here anymore, come to watch me that day, and I ended up scoring. It was Gus's first sort of season, and yeah, things were sort of really coming together for me on the pitch, and I was really getting back to where I needed to get back to, I felt, and feeling good about myself, and felt like I could sort of dine at the top table, if you like. And I'd played well that game, and I'd scored that goal in front of the whole end. And I remember ringing my mum and dad on the way home, and my granddad was in the car or whatever, and he just said, like, I'd love to see you play for a club like that one day. It stuck in my head, and then obviously was lucky enough to go on and captain him further down the line. So yeah, it was a great day.
It's strange because there's a lot of like things that run with parallels with you. I mean, that particular incident in that Bournemouth game, you went off to play for Bournemouth. Yeah. Your first goal for the Albion was against Huddersfield. Mm-hmm. You know, that massive goal for you at Villa Park. You know, and you go on to be successful for Villa. I mean, you know, there are like catch points in all of this. It's mad. Yeah.
Yeah, it's strange. Yeah, I never really thought about it, to be honest. So, yeah, it's strange.
Sorry, listen. I mean, there's one thing I do want to ask you. And obviously, 2010-2011 season, it's one of our favourites, and I've been watching the Albion since, you know, 1978, and it's still up there. You know, almost on a par with the 2016-17 season, because, you know, it was the culmination of, like you say, you say yourself earlier, you couldn't write a script like that, or if you did, people would think it's just a really, really cheesy Hollywood script. You know, that, you know, everything came together. That last moment, we won the third division. I mean, can you imagine Brighton playing in the third division at the Amex? I mean, it just doesn't sort of ring true. But if we sort of look at the final chapter of that, or the beginning of the final chapter of that, now, obviously, you know, Gus, you said, has stuck you on a pedestal and thinks you're the next big thing, which is fair enough. But how easy was it for him? Because we had Charlie Oway on the show saying, you know, when Gus came in with his ideas, everyone was going, what? So how easy was it to get the ideas across from what you were doing before and possibly even unlearn everything?
Yeah, I mean, again, to do it, you need the players, number one. So that was obviously going to take time, but I remember his first game was Southampton away, and we'd had the most horrific defensive record before he'd come in. I mean, we was conceding goals, like it was getting embarrassing. There was threes, fours. If we'd have conceded two, you felt like you won the lottery. and just the way, I remember him doing a back four session, and he put me in Virgs at centre half, and yeah, he was getting us moving and saying, no, stopping it, everything. No, you're the wrong side, get that side right. You're the wrong side, get that side. You get it, I can trust you. You don't get it, you're out. I need someone else in. Right, get that side. Yeah, so it was real basic stuff, getting us defending as a unit, going to Southampton and trying to get a result. We left Glenn to his own sort of accord up top. Listen, let's just try and keep you fresh. The ones behind you do all the sort of diligent work, and when you get a chance, I need you to take it. But again, when you had sort of players, I like to think myself, when you have players like Crofty, when you have players like Elliot Bennett, Glenn Murray, Kazenga Lualua, we was underachieving. So there was talent there, but it just needed to be given a template and a way. And yeah, the first game that down at Southampton is just like, right, well, this fellow obviously he knows what he's on about. Whatever he says goes. And from that point, you layer it, and it gets better and better. And then maybe one week you don't quite get it, and you strip it back a couple of weeks, and then you go again. And yeah, it was just, he somehow got a balance and a blend to the team that worked for that period until he could add to it.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we are just about running out of time here. So, I mean, we have to talk to you again, Tommy, about a lot of the other stuff, you know, particularly about how popular Eddie Howe is in Britain. In not at all. But he's not known as Smug Eddie for nothing, you know.
AD, be nice. Listen, he's just said this is one of the. Actually, no. I mean, as much as we're teasing here, you said that Gus is one of the main fellas in your career. Just quickly, in that case, I know this sort of like does grind us as Albion fans, but, you know, Eddie Howe is clearly one of the main men in your career, Tom. So tell us about that.
He took me to levels that I never knew I had. And the guy's a genius. Like when you talk about coaches, and when I was talking about Dean Wilkins earlier, and then, you know, you come across people like Eddie and yeah, it's just, and used to do everything himself, you know, wouldn't delegate everything. He set the tempo, the work rate. Just attention to detail, like you come away from that, and it's not until you come away from that and you realise how good he actually is, and all of a sudden you're not doing stuff that you've been doing with Eddie, and you think, Jesus Christ, well, why aren't we doing this and why aren't we doing that, and this is how I expect things. And that was tough to deal with when you come away from that, but yeah, I hope to see him back in work soon with a top club, because he's second to none.
Is it, because obviously Eddie went from Bournemouth to Burnley and back again, is it something just a kind of a magic touch about Eddie and Bournemouth, or do you genuinely think that he could and should be managing elsewhere?
Yeah, no, he could and should be, and it's not just a thing with Bournemouth, because I think when you look at what he did at Burnley, all right, he didn't get to where he wanted to get to with them, but the foundations that he laid down going forward for someone like Sean Dyche to pick up and run with, you know, if Eddie hadn't have gone to Burnley when he did and laid down foundations, I don't think they'd be doing as well as what they've gone on to do.
Sure.
Well, just before we go then, Tommy, we have to ask you, what did playing for your hometown club mean for you?
Yeah, just it's something you dream of, and when you're sitting out at the Amex at sort of 15 and 14, 15, 16 and watching it, you know, you always like to think you'd be given the opportunity one day if you do things well enough and you know, work hard enough. And I don't know, really, it's not something that's ever really sunk in with me because I wasn't a massive, massive football fan. I didn't have that emotional attachment. It was always work for me and always something that I could see myself really doing. I suppose going on to win the league with our hometown club after knowing the history and how much we had to struggle. I remember going up to the Gillingham Stadium and being given a sweatshirt because I was in the sort of youth team at the time, walking around the pitch and driving back, and I was thinking that's the last time I'll be driving to Gillingham. So them fans that were doing that and then see them carry over into the with Dean and end it how we did, it's an amazing part of the history of the club, and to have been involved in that, I suppose it's something that I won't really, really appreciate until I'm a lot older, I don't think.
And what next for you?
Yeah, so I want to stay in the game. I'm currently in talks with one of my old clubs about going back and being part of coaching set up there, and yeah, looking forward to that. It'll hopefully all be official in the next sort of week or two. And yeah, as I said, I've said many, many times now, I've always seen my life in football to be sort of 30 or 40 years rather than 15, 20 year playing career and swan off. So looking forward, as I said, I've got so many fond memories of my time growing up at Brighton and was taught so much. It'd be a shame not to go and put that into practice now.
Brighton and Hove Albion nowadays, I guess you do keep in touch with what's going on. How do you view the club? Well, obviously, it's a complete, almost a totally different club to the one you left compared to the one that's now, isn't it?
Yeah, totally different. And that's why I think you touched on it earlier. For the older generation of sort of fans, it's nice to look back on that with Dean period and have a real connection with it, because we was all so close to it. You know, there was only sort of 8,000 or 9,000 every week, and you could really resonate with the team and the lads coming through. So, as I say now, the club's just on a whole new level. A global level that's attracting sort of players from every corner of the world, really. So it's just an absolute monster. I mean, the owner's done such a terrific job with the infrastructure he's put in place and the people that he's got running the football club. And, you know, we touched on Gary Dicker coming back to the club, even keeping that feeling and that DNA within the club as well. Gordon Greer being back at the club. So it's great that they haven't lost touch with what they was, and they're still moving it on. So it's a testament to the owners and the people running it, how well they're doing.
Well, Tommy, fantastic. Thanks for everything you did for us, mate, and good luck in whatever you do next.
Yep, absolutely. And with that, thank you to Tommy. Thank you to Alan Wares. I've been AD Packham. This has been the Albion Roar on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on TAB, and of course on our podcast. We'll see you again next week. Thanks, Chris. Bye.